This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, from the arts to sports, and from business to history, and everything in between, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. They're some of our favorites. And today we have a story from where we live, right here in Oxford, Mississippi, and it's a small town, a small college town, home of Ole Miss, about an hour south of Memphis. Steve Thomas has lived in our town for over 30 years. Today, he's here to share with us his story. Take it away, Faith.
Steve Thomas is a magician and balloon-making expert. He goes to the local farmers market and events here in town to make balloons for people. He's our own personal small-town celebrity. Steve has always loved magic, but his path to full-time magician and balloon artist didn't start until his 40s. Steve has had several jobs throughout his career. He started off in radio, where he worked for over 20 years. After his time in radio came to an end, he went to work for FedEx and became a dangerous goods specialist. He worked at FedEx for 14 years. Until one day, something happened. Just over a decade ago, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
I was at work one night and I picked up a one-pound box and turned around and set it down and my shoulder popped. And that was all she wrote for the shoulder. So I ended up having really extensive 4 different procedures on my right shoulder. And when I got done with that, I had a little tremor. And the doctor eventually figured out what it was. And of course, FedEx said, if you can't come back to work at 100%, don't come back at all. There's several different ways that you can manifest the condition. It's basically your body doesn't produce enough dopamine or produces too much dopamine, or your dopamine receptors, the things that take it in after it's produced, don't work correctly, or the synapses that go from the muscles to the brain don't work correctly because of the lack of that. So it's just a long process of trying to figure out what medicine to give you, whether you need more dopamine, whether you need the receptors worked on. And now they're talking about brain surgery and, you know, I mean, I have the best brain in the world, but I only get one. And I don't want them to go digging around in there and hook the wrong voltage battery up. It's progressive. But like my doctor said, and I've had 3 or 4 doctors because they move off. They're all neuromotor specialists. And they'll tell you Parkinson's doesn't kill you. You don't die from Parkinson's. I mean, you may lose the use of an arm or a leg or get tremors. And mine's unilateral. It's in the left side of my brain, which means it affects the right side of my body. And about 80% of it's in my arm, 20% in my leg, occasionally a little flutter in my eye. But if you meet me and watch me work, chances are if I'm not moving or doing anything, I'll have a hand in my pocket. That's to kind of hide that little tremor thing that goes on. But it gets to a lot of people, you know. Oh, my father was diagnosed at one point in his late years with what they thought was Parkinson's, and he cried. You know, I don't see the purpose in crying. It's non-productive.
Steve was not always so relaxed in his response to life.
You gotta realize when I was a kid, I was a ball of nerves. I had an ulcer when I was like 6. Yeah, peptic ulcer just from worrying and stress. I learned early on, worrying doesn't change anything. It's not going to change the outcome of anything. Just do what you're going to do and be who you're going to be. Bleeding ulcer will do that for you. When they start talking about, you got to take this medicine as long as you have it. But you know, that was a long time ago, I'm sure. It may not have even been what the doctor said it was. But you just can't let it get to you. I mean, you're going to spend your day that would be an otherwise good day worrying about how tomorrow is going to be, then you just screwed up today. I guess I can talk about Parkinson's patients because I am one. You know, relax. I mean, I know people who've had Parkinson's 2 years and they can't get up out of a wheelchair. And I, you know, mine is minimal. My progression is very minimal. If it hadn't been for the results of a DAT scan, I don't think the doctor would even admit that I had it, but it showed up. You know, they inject you with some radioactive stuff and then stick in a CAT scan machine.
After he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, he left FedEx and returned to something he was familiar with, magic.
I've actually been doing magic and entertaining people for 44 years now. And when I was a kid, I did shows. Did my first show when I was 9. It was a paid thing. I remember because my buddy and I performed together, and we told her it was $5. And she gave us each $5. Well, we thought we'd hit a gold mine if you get paid twice as much as you're expecting. So did that for a while, and then I packed away all the magic when I got into the radio thing because that, you know, I was up at 3 o'clock every morning. And after I got married or met my wife, I was at my father's house and I went in his storage shed, and there's all this magic stuff. I thought, well, why don't I start using some of this? So it went from, you know, liquor store cardboard box full of magic stuff to I have 1,000 square feet in my house now that's nothing but magic. Everything on the walls, you know, everything decorating, all the books, 12 bookcases full of magic books. And somewhere along in there, while I was entertaining it, because I did 12 years at Pizza Hut restaurants for kids' night, somewhere in there, I decided to take up balloon art because they wanted something more conducive to littler kids. So I started doing that probably 15, 16 years ago.
And you've been listening to Steve Thomas, and he's our local celebrity, the magician, the guy who shows up at the parties, entertains the kids. Everybody knows him in town. Struck with Parkinson, a tough disease. He said, I didn't see the purpose in crying. It's non-productive. And he knew a lot about the kind of person who worries himself to death because he was that person when he was younger. More of Steve Thomas's life here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com. And we return to Our American Stories and to Steve Thomas's story, our local magician and balloon art expert. Let's return to Faith and continue this story.
When Steve was young, he had to read a lot of books in order to learn about magic.
You would go to the library and you'd check out whatever magic book you could find and you'd absorb everything in that. And after you've covered all the magic books, even back then, there wasn't much to do, especially here. There's a magic shop in Memphis. My parents would take me there occasionally, and I would learn a couple things from one of the guys working there and work on those. Now I have kids who come over to my house for magic tutoring and magic lessons. Kind of, I guess what comes around goes around. And I'm glad to see some kids getting into magic.
Steve performs for all ages, but he has his favorites.
You know, there's nothing better than a birthday party for like a 50-year-old lady, and everybody's having a good time, and you can just do things because you don't, with people that age, you don't have to worry about comprehension. Whereas if you have a group of 50 kids and there's some 3 and 4 and 5 year olds in there, there's a little comprehension issue. You have to keep gear things toward the younger audience. And, you know, I do that. Well, I live just to make kids smile and laugh.
Throughout his magic career, Steve's son and daughter have played roles in some of his shows. There are many times he's taken a show on the road, which provided some great quality time for Steve and his son.
Everywhere from furthest north I've been is New London, Missouri. Furthest south is New Orleans and any state in between there. I'm getting kind of old and I'm not big on that, you know, 2 weeks away from home thing. But we used to do library shows every summer we would book 2 weeks, and every day we would have two shows in two different towns. And my son and I would load up all our stuff, and we'd go out, go to the town, get a hotel room, go set up the stuff at the library, go have dinner, go home, go back to the hotel, go to sleep, get up the next day, do the show, move on to the next town. Some of our best times and some of the most interesting conversations we've ever had. Yeah, because my son could come up with some lines that would crack you up. He's a hilarious human being. Some of our funniest moments were in New Orleans. One I distinctly remember, he was 11, and I scheduled a meeting with a friend of mine who also does balloons, and he's a clown, and he's goofy. So we're in this little hole in the wall, like five-table bar, middle of the day, and we start doing balloons. There's a big pile of balloons on the table, and this drunk blonde girl comes up and says, "Oh, do you two do balloons?" And I looked at my friend, and he looked at me, and we just shook our heads. So we made some balloons for her, and she gave us a bunch of money. And my son's sitting there being real quiet. So she came time to leave, for her to leave, and she walked up, and she gave us some more money. And she had a basketball pick sheet. And I don't know the first thing about sports. I know football's the one that's pointy on the ends. That's the only thing I know. But she came up and she said, "I need somebody to help me with this basketball pick sheet. Can you help me?" And my buddy Joe, he didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about it. I said, "Here's your man right here," pointing at my son. He's 11. So he BS'd her along with the best of them. And she gave him some money. And she said, "My son's 11. She's college." She said, "Well, I don't know how I can ever thank you." And he looked her square in the eye and he said, "How about you give me your phone number?" And I was speechless, and that's very rare for me to be speechless. I said, "Boy, what did you say? You are 11 years old." He said, "Can't hurt to ask."
After living in Oxford for so many years and doing magic and balloon art for parties throughout that time, Steve is widely recognized. I met Steve at the coffee shop on the square here in town. If you go there often enough, you'll begin to see a lot of the same people.
And there are always kids in there, and they're always coming up to the table talking to me, and they're always waving at me from across the room. And I think that's great. I love making friends, and I've seen these kids grow up. I get parents who come up to me and say, "Oh, yeah, you did my birthday party when I was 5. This is my little girl. She's 7. We want to see if you can come to her party." So along with making me feel really old, it makes me feel good that they remember who I am and what I do. Some people who are children's entertainers talk about, "Oh, the kids are so bad. The kids are so bad. What do you do to keep the kids in line while you're doing shows? What are some of your techniques?" Well, my technique is I'm 6'3" and I weigh 265 pounds. And I've developed this little goatee that has a purpose. Makes you look a little more grown up. I have an earring in each ear, which I guess makes the kids think you're not like a normal, you're not like dad. So they tend to act right.
Of course, before our conversation was over, I had to ask Steve to make a balloon for me. He carries balloons with him all the time.
And of course I carry balloons with me. What do we have here? Let's see what happens. Oh, perfect, perfect. And if you ever see me in the coffee shop, whip out a bag of balloons, I'm trying to cheer up a kid who looks like he's having a bad day. And that's another thing that most people don't realize is people see me do balloons and I mouth inflate. Most people don't, because it takes a lot of lung power to blow up one of these balloons. And I have apnea, so I sleep with a breathing machine every night. Well, in one of my pulmonologist meetings or appointments, I told the doctor what I do, and he's like, "Well, let's test you out." So he tested out my lung capacity, and I have almost double the lung capacity and lung strength from doing this. So you take the green one and you twist it and you twist it and you twist it. I could give you a ballooning lesson. Next time I see you in the coffee shop, I'll bring out a bag of balloons. It looks less creepy if somebody's sitting there with you doing it. And And, you know, there are a lot of people who are fantastic with balloons. I have friends all over the world who can make life-size motorcycles. And, well, that's great, but that takes like 3 days. I would rather make something quick and easy. And I think my entertainment value comes more in the interaction between me and the child or the parents than it does the fact that your balloon looks exactly like, you know, Ronald Reagan or whoever, whatever you're trying to make. Then you take the heart, stretch the heart, tweak the heart. And people watch me do balloons a lot of times. Because I'll carry on a conversation the same time I'm doing it. You're not even watching what you're doing. Anything I can make behind my back or without looking at what I'm doing. Ta-da! And this goes on your arm. I'll save it for you. I won't walk out with it. And, you know, that will put a smile on a teacher's face, a child's face, a mom's face. Doesn't matter, 80-year-old lady. I think it's that you can be creative with them, but, you know, if you give just a round balloon, and I don't recommend doing this because even I have my limitations. I won't do a balloon for anybody under 4 because of the whole choking hazard. If I know the child and I know that they're smart enough to not be sticking their fist in their mouth, I'll do a balloon for them. But if you give like a 5-year-old a round balloon, just a round balloon with no picture on it or anything, they'll play with it until it pops. They'll play with it for hours. And I don't know what it is. Just, what do they say? It's a gift. It's a bag of my breath.
That's our local magician and balloon art expert, Steve Thomas. And I'm Faith Buchanan for Our American Stories.
It's just a bag of my breath. It's much more than that. Any of us could try this. I've tried 100 times. In fact, this year, I now have a new New Year's resolution. It's to get Steve Thomas to teach me how to do balloons. I live just to make kids smile and laugh, he said. And I try to cheer up a kid who's having a bad day. A great story about a guy who deals with, well, a really tough and slow and debilitating disease called Parkinson's by ignoring it and just going on about his day, cheerfully making other people's days happier. Steve Thomas's story, here on Our American Stories. We continue here with Our American Stories. Grabbing a basket while grocery shopping may seem second nature today, but the idea was once groundbreaking, and that was far from the only thing that changed when Piggly Wiggly, the first modern American supermarket, opened over 100 years ago. On September 6, 1916, hundreds of curious shoppers came out for the opening of a new grocery store at 79 Jefferson Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee. And we broadcast here in Oxford, Mississippi. Memphis is only 1 hour practically due north. For weeks, they'd seen billboards and read newspaper ads about this grocery store with the funny name that promised an entirely new shopping experience, one that would, according to its owner, forever change the retail grocery business. Greg Hengler sat down with Mike Freeman near the location of that first Piggly Wiggly in downtown Memphis. Mike Freeman is the author of Clarence Saunders and the Founding of Piggly Wiggly, The Rise and Fall of a Memphis Maverick.
I took a job at a restaurant in downtown Memphis that happened to be at 79 Jefferson. And that was the first location of the Piggly Wiggly store. It was an interesting fact. You know, I became interested in that. My employer wanted me to do some research because he was curious as well, you know, what happened in the building and such. It's important to note what Saunders did differently was, in the old days, if you went into a store to shop, you couldn't just reach out and pick out your own groceries. You had clerks do that for you. So you had to wait for them to, you tell the clerk what you want and then they would bring it to you. And Saunders thought, well, this is really slow. This is so inefficient. And all this tied in with brand advertising. Before the turn of the century, you had all these brands we still recognize, Kellogg's cereal, Van Camp. pork and beans. All these companies were selling their products in stores. And Saunders knew, well, you don't need a clerk to tell you what cereal you like. You like Kellogg's cereal? There it is. You get it yourself. The most important thing to him is I could sell more groceries at less cost because I could pay fewer people. Saunders grew up from a family that was poor. In fact, there's one story that a neighbor bought Clarence a pair of shoes. And then when Saunders had money later in life, he sent a check to that family for a number of years because they helped him out and he really needed it. So he knew what it was like to suffer, you know, to live in hardship, and he carried that with him. You know, that probably motivated him as much as anything to do something. Saunders became a traveling salesman for a wholesale company. So he would call upon grocers. And Saunders developed a reputation for being a bit brash. He would go into a store and he would tell the store owner, says, you know, you would sell more vegetables if you displayed them this way instead of the way you had it. And some thought, well, what does this guy know? So not everybody appreciated his advice. But it shows that he was already thinking about, you know, trying ways to do things a bit better than before. There was a man in Memphis who built a chain of stores, Mr. Bauer's stores. They were small, like corner grocery stores, but every Bauer's store looked exactly the same as the signs in the front and the layout of the store where the groceries were placed. So each Bauer's store was identical. And that was an innovation, too. If you went from one store to the other, you'd know exactly where to find what you wanted to buy because everything was in the same place, despite, you know, in different locations. And Saunders, he absorbed these ideas. That's the principle of a chain store. Everything is alike as much as it can be. So if you're comfortable with what they do, then you'll shop at the chain store no matter where that location is. So you could go into a town where you unfamiliar to you and find your favorite grocery, you know, whatever the business is, or Starbucks for that matter, and get exactly what you want. And that's the whole principle of chain store. Bauer's did that before Saunders. So he clearly learned from Bauer's how to manage a chain store business. The one thing that Bauer's did not do was arrange things for customers to pick out themselves. So you still had clerks, and Saunders thought this was an inefficient way of doing things. And he was kind of sarcastic. He says, you know, in a store is not very busy, the poor customer can't get the attention of a clerk because they're busy goofing off in the back room. He says, if that happens, or they're so busy, like during Christmas season, you know, everyone's shopping in the store so busy they can't handle the orders properly. The arrangement of the store that Bauer's and the older merchants had was, as you walked up to a counter, and once you had your clerk's attention, you would rattle off what you wanted, and then he would go about the rest of the store, picking out the items you wanted and bring them to the front. And then you would transact business, and off you go. And Saunders thought, well, you know, they don't need a clerk to tell them that Campbell's soup is good, or if you just put it on a shelf, they can find it themselves. He took this journey to Terre Haute, Indiana, to look at a store that he was told was unique and designed differently. And he came back a bit disappointed. It wasn't really anything special at all. And Saunders told the story often. He said on the way back, he saw this mother pig at a farm, and he saw all these piglets trying to feed off the mother pig, and it reminded him of customers trying to attract attention of a clerk. And then the idea popped in his head. He had the name Piggly Wiggly just from seeing this pig. Okay, that's the name. And then he went about designing, well, how are we going to actually do this? You'd have to practically rebuild the interior of the store to change it to self-service. Piggly Wiggly, you know, that was his name. And It was a very unusual name. I mean, I think it was perfect for what he was trying to do because he was being different. And then he began writing advertisements where Piggly Wiggly became a character. Piggly Wiggly goes to town, you know, Piggly Wiggly does this. And so, you know, that's how he built his brand identity. He made a story out of an imaginary pig that went shopping. I'll read part of one. It's Piggly Wiggly. Ain't that a funny name? The fellow that got up that name must have a screw loose somewheres. All this may be so, but the Piggly Wiggly knows its own business best, and its business will be this. To have no store clerks gab and smirk while folks are standing around 10 deep to get waited on. Every customer will be her own clerk. So if she wants to talk to a can of tomatoes and kill her time, all right and well. But it seems likely this would be a mighty lonesome chat. Saunders addressed customer fears. You know, it used to be, if you went into certain stores in the old days, and you know, the clerk might put his thumb on the scale so you'd pay extra for tomatoes or potatoes or whatever, or they'd sell you food that was out of date. And Saunders thought all that was just wrong. It was just not good business. You could sell more groceries just by being honest. And he was very proud. He talked a lot about labeling prices on everything. So you walk in and you go to the canned soup aisle, you know exactly what the price of that soup is. And it didn't matter what store you're in, one of his stores, they all price things about the same. And it didn't matter who you were or whether the clerk knew you or not, you got the same price.
When we come back, more of Mike Freeman telling the story of Clarence Saunders, the founder of Piggly Wiggly, here on Our American Story. And we continue with Our American Stories and with author Mike Freeman telling the story of Piggly Wiggly and its founder, Clarence Saunders. Let's continue with Mike.
He knew he was taking a less profit, and he probably had people in the grocery business say, well, you can't make any money. You're not selling high enough. You're not making enough profit. But he was looking at volume. You know, and he could open, the more stores you open, the more volume you have. And then, you know, one of the benefits of self-service is you are selling more goods per day. And that helps eliminate the problem of spoiled food or expired food. And Saunders was aware of that. And he would advertise to people, see, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to treat you fair. I mean, now you can't imagine going in a store and not having a label on it. And this is 32 cents or whatever. Can't imagine it. But for, you know, the 20th century, that was commonplace. You know, once you label everything, then no grocery store can hide. You know, his competitors are thinking, uh-oh, you know, we're going to have to do something different. You know, he proved right there that first year that he had about 8 or 9 stores in Memphis, and Bowers had over 40, and he outsold Bowers stores simply because he made it easier for people to shop, and they just started swarming into Piggly Wiggly's. You know, he's one of those rare individuals that has an idea that worked, and it transformed part of our society. You know, I don't say he's as great as Henry Ford, but you know, Ford decided, well, why can't we put an engine in this little carriage and then hook it up to some wheels, and then we don't need a horse and buggy anymore. We have a car. Changed the world. Now, Saunders isn't of that level of success, but I think he had the same mind where he thought, well, let's do something a little different here. You know, the old ways are, you can do a little faster, a little bit better than that. And then that's what Piggly Wiggly was. Grocery store's version of the Model T. What's interesting is that next year, he started franchising. And well, he actually filed for several patents. He got several patents. But he started selling the idea that, well, you guys down in Arkansas and Mississippi, you can build a piggy wiggly. You know, there's towns all over the South that were large enough to support a couple of grocery stores. And then that proceeded very rapidly, selling franchises all over the place. You could argue that the founder of Walmart did virtually the same thing. He put a Walmart in medium-sized towns. You know, if a town doesn't have a Walmart, then it's kind of not a town. But having a store like that in your community, hiring the local folks to work in the store, probably manage the store, it built a loyalty for that brand that for Walmart still exists. The difference between Walton and Saunders is Walton never lost his business. He held on to it. Where I think Saunders had a lot of the same attitudes, same personality in some way. He wanted to be that champion, but in the end, he didn't keep that business long enough. You know, right now, most people don't know who Saunders is. Saunders achieved a level of celebrity and wealth that most people only dream of. He's most famous for the Pink Palace is a building. I don't know how many square feet it
36,000.
Well, they've added on to it, but the majority of that 36,000 square feet is what he built. It was to have a swimming pool, it was to have everything a rich person would want. Saunders tried to outsmart traders of Wall Street, and to explain it simply, he didn't realize they wrote the rules of trade. There was no governing agency overseeing financial trade that we have now. It was whatever certain people who, what we call Wall Street, decided to do is what was done. They made the rules among themselves. I have trouble sometimes describing a short sale. It's just a stock maneuver where different people in the financial business spread rumors that a company's in trouble, that the stock's not worth what it's listing at now. And Saunders thought that was horrible. Piggly Wiggly had overexpanded, and there was a franchisor or two that had gone bankrupt. And that was all the trigger that these short sellers needed. And he started this campaign is to take the shares out of the hands of these Wall Street thieves or wolves. And he started a buying campaign in Memphis, you know, save Piggly Wiggly from Memphis. His most people in Memphis or, you know, any city outside of New York probably thought about Wall Street the same as he did. And it was sort of this kind of a villainous place. And he was playing on that. You know, don't let these thieves take our Piggly Wiggly away from us. So everyone invested in Saunders' scheme to buy all the shares and hold them. Well, he pushed these traders into a panic because whatever they borrow, they have to pay. And if he's buying all the shares, they have to come to him to repay what they owe him. I mean, he was trying to trap them. And the board of directors of the stock exchange in New York kept Saunders from doing that and let the traders off the hook. They could change the rules. See, there's no government agency overseeing stock trade. Whatever the board of directors thought was legal was illegal. And especially if they had friends who got caught up in the scheme and begging, you know, don't let us die out here. They said, well, we'll let Saunders die. You know, they don't know him. They don't care about him. He's not part of their social group or anything like that at all. He's just some hillbilly from Tennessee who thought he knew what he was doing. They just, you know, interpreted rules to let him die. So he had borrowed all that money instead of gaining what he thought would be hundreds of millions of dollars. He had nothing. You know, $12 million is a lot of money today to lose. Imagine what it was like in 1923. You know, so. What Saunders had done, and there were people that really liked him because he was, you know, become very famous, was that he had begged Memphians to pool together money to pay off this debt so that Piggly Wiggly could get back to normal operating under his leadership. And people did. They held rallies for Save Piggly Wiggly from Memphis. That was the campaign. Not for Saunders. He was careful to say, Save Piggly Wiggly from Memphis. And he had a point there too. I mean, you know, there's a lot of jobs in Memphis now because of this store, this business. And then he made the dumb mistake of putting money into this, what we now know as the Pink Palace, which was an extravagant home. This is, you know, and people that invested in Piggly Wiggly must have been shocked. Says, what in the world are you doing? We're taking time away from our business, spending our money to bail you out, and you're building this stupid house. You know, you don't have time for that anymore.
How did they find out about it?
Well, a workman had been injured, and the newspaper published a story. You know, it was, holy cow, you know, they couldn't believe it. I mean, it was this terrible mistake he made. And it cost him, well, I mean, he tried again to make money, and he did, but, I mean, he's still famous for what? Piggly Wiggly. And he lost, he only ran this company for 6 years. I guess that the story was remarkable in itself, is that he started with one store. 6 years later, he had a 1,000. I mean, you know, he had a substantial chain. But, I mean, he was successful. He did build something that was unique. He just didn't hold on to it. I mean, he would be Sam Walton today, or his memory would be as big as Sam Walton if he had just held on to Piggly Wiggly like Walton held on to Walmart. The most fitting memorial to him is the ordinary self-service store. Sam Walton founded Walmart in 1962. By the end of his life in 1992, Walton owned the largest retail merchandising company in the world. In his autobiography, Sam Walton Made in America, he credited the enormous success of his retail stores to the principle of self-service. His brief description of the benefits that self-service gave to him and his desire to pass on the savings to his customers seemed to be a near match to Saunders' own words two generations before. During the past 25 years, supermarkets and large merchandise stores have become popular in nearly every country in Europe, Asia, Latin America, and parts of Africa. In an odd way, Clarence Saunders' prophetic slogan for Piggly Wiggly all over the world has come true.
And great job on the piece, as always, by Greg Hengler. And a special thanks to Mike Freeman, who wrote the book Clarence Saunders and the Founding of Piggly Wiggly. And what a story. And that he started the idea of pricing and transparency and volume so that we could lower profits on each individual item, but make up for that with volume. And that is indeed what Sam Walton did. There's no doubt that Sam took a lot of the ideas of Piggly Wiggly and scaled them to a much larger operation. The story of Piggly Wiggly, the story of Clarence Saunders, here on Our American Stories.